You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the show. Today is June 20th. It's a Thursday. Thank you for joining us. A beautiful day in LA today. Sunny, getting warm, and we're happy to have in the studio Mr. Fritz Coleman. Welcome to the show, sir.
I'm happy to be here, Sam.
Thank you so much.
The voice of Los Angeles. Sam,
yes, sir.
Right here I am looking at it.
You're more the voice of Los Angeles than I am. You've been around for a long time.
Too many years.
Yeah. That's true. I'm a big fan. I used to watch you on TV as the weatherman. When did you retire from that?
I retired in March of 2020. And I was going to retire a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. but that's just at the beginning of the lockdown. And they were just beginning to do reporting from home, where they came and set up a camera in your house. And so my boss, because it was going to be a kind of a bumpy transition, asked me to stay on a couple of additional months. I was at the end of my contract. And I said, I'll do it. I get to do the weather from my den in my pajama bottoms. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
So I had a good time. Now, so March of 2020, I can't believe I've been retired that long, but I'm having a great time.
Wow, I'm sure. So what do you do for your free time, with all your free time now?
I know this sounds like an exaggeration. I'm busier now than I was when I was working.
Really?
I'm on the board of directors of three nonprofit organizations because I love doing fundraising. And my stand-up career is just on fire right now. I got extended for the third time at the El Portal Theater in North Hollywood. Mm-hmm. We're going to be there through November once a month. And I'm so happy. I'm busy. I've got grandchildren. Life is good. I'm very, very, very
awesome.
Blessed.
I'm really happy for you.
Yeah.
Because some people, you know, they retire and they just sort of like don't do much, you know. It's like sort of like the end of their life, you know, but you got to make something of it.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because my father, my father was the classic post-World War II businessman where his whole identity was his work. And then when he was forced to retire at 65 years old, over a period of time, I just watched this man implode because he wasn't interested in anything. He didn't like movies. He didn't like books. He liked a little TV. He liked to work in the yard. But then when he got too old to work in the yard, he just lost interest in everything, and I thought, oh, my God, I hope that doesn't happen to me. My life is so not like that.
That's
I'm
amazing.
Completely the opposite.
You're a very active person.
Yes, and I love it. I'm busy, and time just goes crazy.
Really? Yeah. How many grandkids do you have?
Two. I have an 11 and an 8-year-old. 11-year-old granddaughter and an 8-year-old grandson.
That's amazing.
And next Monday, we're taking them on a cruise out of San Pedro for 4 days.
Mexico.
Yes, it's the Mexican cruise. You go to what do you call it? Catalina one night, then you go down.
Right.
And it's one of these great boats that has all kinds of, you know,
fun
water rides. Yes, for kids and we're going
to
have a blast.
Yeah, I've been on those cruises. It's pretty cool. It goes to like Puerto Vallarta,
yeah,
I think, right?
Yeah.
And Mazatlan, I think, and Cabo.
It's 4 days. It's just long enough to test their patience and our patience, and then we'll be back.
Yeah. That's good. I'm really glad for you.
Yeah.
They're going to have a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
And how many kids do you have?
I have three children.
Three children.
I have 37, 35, and 23, soon to be 24. My youngest child just graduated from this fine establishment, Loyola Marymount University.
Okay.
And she's going to graduate school at Pepperdine.
Oh, wow.
Because she's the smartest member of the family.
Oh, yeah.
Intimidatingly smart. And so we're very proud of her. And everybody else is just having a good life. Everybody's healthy. We're very thankful.
Very good. Did you go to college?
Yes, I went to Temple University in Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
I did not get a degree because I was in the radio business at the time.
Oh.
And I got a job offer that I could not refuse.
Mm-hmm.
So I left, you know, like 35 credits short of having a degree.
Oh.
But that's an assessment you have to make. You have to say, am I going to go to college and then still be making jobs at this salary when I leave? Or should I just blow it off and go make a living?
Yeah,
and so I just blew it off. I have a slight resentment that I didn't finish, but it was a great job. So
Besides, you can always go back. I mean, you might as well, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I would be a better college student now than I was, because I'm interested in everything now.
Yeah, yeah.
You could take me to the Styrofoam Museum and drop me off, and I would just have a great time.
Yeah.
Because I'm interested in, when I was a kid, I just wanted to do what I wanted to do and then go party.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I went back to college when I was 26.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and I did great. You know, I was on the dean's list and everything, graduated with honors, because when you go later, I don't think people should go to school right after high school.
First of all, they don't know what they want to do.
Yeah, and they're tired of school, too. I mean, you've gone for, like, you know, 12 years. It's enough. You want to take a break, you know?
Amen. That's,
and that's true. You go there to socialize, like you said, you know?
Right.
When you're older, you approach it like a business,
yes,
you know?
And you're more patient, you have a work ethic, and you're interested in more
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly.
I wish I could. If I won the lottery, I would go back to college now.
You don't have to win it. You just find some time between your comedy and everything.
Yeah.
You know, have you been doing comedy like for a long time?
Yes, I did. This is an odd story, Sam, but it's a true story. Okay. I got my job doing weather from doing stand-up in November of 1982. Mm-hmm. I was performing at the Comedy Store in Sunset Boulevard, and the news director from Channel 4 Los Angeles was in the audience with his wife. And I talked on stage about having done the weather in the Navy. I worked for Armed Forces Radio and Television. I was in the Navy for 4 years.
Wow.
And I had a couple of anecdotes about being forced to do the weather against my will. They wanted me to do the weather. I didn't know anything about weather. They didn't care. They just needed somebody to do it. So I told a story about that. And so after the show was over, this man, Steve Antonetti, God rest his soul, came up to me and said, I loved your story about doing the weather and not knowing anything about it. Do you have any desire to come to Channel 4 and do some vacation relief fill-in for me and weekend weather? And he said, I need a guy desperately. And I was making $25 a night at the Comedy Store, and I almost fainted.
Yeah.
I said, oh, my God, when do you want me to start?
Yeah.
And he said, well, you have to audition first. And I said, you did hear me say that I don't know anything about weather. And this guy said, perfect. There's no weather in California. This will work out great. So I auditioned.
It's the same every day.
It's the same. You know, between April and October, it's morning clouds and fog, hazy afternoon sun.
Yeah.
I just had to pretend I've never said those words before.
And well, you say them in many different
ways,
right?
Yes, that's the whole, the creativity of it is thinking up new ways to say the same forecast. So I auditioned and I got the job, and I did the weekend fill-in for 2 years. Then the main weatherman, my predecessor, left and went to CBS, and I was bumped up and had the main job.
Mm-hmm.
And I retired in March of 2020, 2 weeks shy of my 40th anniversary at NBC.
That's amazing.
Unbelievable.
That's a long time.
And the older I get, the more grateful. I look back, and I've had so much amazing luck.
Yeah.
I really have.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a long run, you know.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
At one station, forget about it.
Yeah, and you got famous from that, obviously, you know, and did you get gigs because of that?
Yes. I mean, I was huge between Santa Barbara and the Mexican border. Now, I didn't get many gigs outside California. But then I did 8 Tonight Show appearances with both Johnny Carson and Jay Leno, and
amazing.
That got me work outside of California.
I'm sure.
That got me Las Vegas work, and I opened for Ray Charles, and I opened for Debbie Reynolds, and I did a lot of opening act work. And then, but I had to balance it with my weather responsibilities. But when I first came out here to do comedy, I was doing the road. And when you're an undiscovered comedian, you're what we call a feature act or a middle act. So you do a comedy club, there are 3 acts. The opening act is usually the MC. Then you have a feature act that does 20 or 25 minutes. Then you have the headliner, which is usually a person that has some national fame.
Right.
I had no national fame, so I'm a middle act. So I was doing 6 nights for $600 and often paying for my own transportation. And I had 2 kids. So I had to take this weather job. My weather job saved me. It gave me the opportunity to give my children a stable life. And so I did not miss the road. I kept the weather job, but I was also able to do stand-up. I did 2 or 3 shows a week of stand-up, even when I was doing the weather.
That's amazing. Yeah, I know a lot of comics are struggling, you know. They don't make a lot of money, and they're just happy when venues invite them, you know, like to go and do a show, you know, because there's just so much competition in this, you know.
Fortunately, so
stand
now,
out. Go ahead.
I was going to say, fortunately, now we have cable and you have Netflix and Prime and all these are giving these guys great venues to stretch out and do a long period of time.
That's true.
It used to be that if you couldn't do the Johnny Carson show or the Merv Griffin show or the Mike Douglas show, you didn't get anywhere because that was your national television exposure.
That's true.
Now those late night shows don't even expose that many comedians. Mm-hmm. Now you have Netflix and all these shows that show you in long form and you can do your own and you don't have to be conscious of, you know, words. You can use whatever language you want. And it's a different ballgame. So guys can get famous purely out of social media now.
Yeah, that's true. It's a different world, you know. I mean, things have changed so much. You said you worked for Debbie Reynolds. Is that when she had the casino in Las Vegas? Or?
No, this was late in her life. As a matter of fact, I did several opening acts for her. The last one was at a fundraiser for the Orange County Performing Arts Center. And then I work at the El Portal now, and that was her home base.
Oh, really?
There's great history in that.
Yeah.
You know, she was born and raised in Burbank.
Right.
And the El Portal Theater on Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood was a vaudeville house. Bob Hope and Red Buttons used to perform there when it was a vaudeville house in the 20s and 30s. And then it became a movie palace, a big movie theater. And that's where Debbie Reynolds would ride her bike when she was like 10 years old to go watch the movies.
Yeah.
And so when she was getting ready for her Vegas performances or on the road, she would work them out there at the El Portal. So they named the stage the Debbie Reynolds Stage.
Oh, wow.
So I open for her and I get to work there in the theater and it's a lot of fun. So there's some great historical connection there.
Yeah.
She was one of the funniest people I've ever worked for.
She really was. You know, I worked for her too. She had a casino in Vegas in the 90s.
Oh, no
kidding. I don't know if you remember that. It was like across the street from the Landmark, which is gone now, but she had a hotel, a casino, and they also her son Todd Fisher, who is Carrie Fisher's brother, he opened like a Hollywood museum because she had collected some $50 million worth
unbelievable
of props and stuff. She had like the red shoes from the Wizard of Oz and the Cleopatra headdress and all that stuff. And it was just amazing. So he wanted to do like sort of like an audiovisual museum, what is what they called it.
Yeah.
It had like a rotating stage and different scenes. And he hired me because I was doing 3D animation back then. So I recreated like scenes for movies and stuff. And then we would put the clothes, you know, that people wore, the costume and everything. And it was just amazing, you know?
Yeah.
I created the...
Todd was there when we donated the theater to his mom.
Yeah.
Carrie had already passed.
Yeah.
So I got to meet him briefly for one day.
Yeah. He's a really cool guy.
Yeah.
And it was funny when he hired me, I went for the interview because, I mean, I reached out to him because I read an article about what he was doing and I lived in Vegas at the time. So I reached out to him. I said, you know, I do this, I do that, are you interested? He says, come on down. So I went down and for the interview. And when I go in, he's like underneath the desk, setting up equipment and everything. And that's how the interview went. You know, he's under the desk and I'm sitting there answering the questions, you know.
And so you did 3D like special effects for shows in Las Vegas.
Right.
That's fantastic.
Well, actually, I started a company. I did, animation for companies. You know, I got some equipment and some software that I was able to do things just like they did on big workstations, you know. And I was able to bring all these high-end graphics to businesses to showcase their products and everything. So then I got into I was working at a computer game company called Westwood Studios in Vegas. And so I was working there. And then when I finished the gig, I found the one with Debbie Reynolds. So I got to meet her. They also had a theater where they showed old movies and they would bring the stars like Esther Williams and Zsa Gabor and all them. And it was just amazing, you know.
People
it was
probably
a good time.
Ate that up, I'm sure.
It was really nice.
I opened for her 3 or 4 times. And we always had the same sort of rhythm. I would open up and do a half hour. Then my job was to walk off stage and get a bouquet of roses and then introduce her and hand her the roses that go out. Right. And she always did the same joke. She'd walk up, because I'm really thin, she'd walk up and put her hand on my face and wait for the audience to stop applauding and say, now go home and have a sandwich. She was so funny.
Yes, she really was.
Extemporaneously funny.
Right.
She worked with that piano player that she worked with all the time. Mm-hmm. I only worked with her when she had kind of a small, pared-down group of musicians, but she was very talented lady.
Yeah, she really was. And she was unfortunate because she always was surrounded by people that wanted to rip her off.
Took advantage of her husband, took all that money. It's very, very sad.
I know. And then when she opened the hotel, the executives there started embezzling and stuff like that. I'm like, you know, so they ended up closing it. But it's unfortunate.
That was way before my time.
Yeah.
That was in the 90s.
I don't know when you were.
I was toward the end of her life.
Oh.
So this was, you know, all told 10 years ago and slightly before. So.
I see. Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in memory of Debbie Reynolds, you know.
I mean, man.
She was big. The younger generation doesn't know her. They know Elizabeth Taylor, but they don't know that Elizabeth Taylor stole Debbie Reynolds' husband, Eddie Fisher.
And she always felt bad about that because she said it was a bad marriage. I know. But, I mean, Debbie was like the full package.
Yeah.
If you watch Singing in the Rain and some of these, her dancing and singing, she was a flawless performer and full of energy. And
Very cool. So you've been doing comedy. What attracted you to comedy? I mean, did you like see comedians and say, I want to do this?
Yes.
Or, really?
Yes, that's exactly what happened.
Oh, wow.
I was in theater in college.
Mm-hmm.
And the only part about theater I really enjoyed was getting the laughs.
Uh-huh.
And I would watch all the comedians on, you know, The Tonight Show doing their little 5-minute snippets. But that's not really stand-up. And then my uncle, when I was a junior in high school, bought me tickets to see George Carlin at an outdoor venue where I grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
It was a place called the Valley Forge Music Fair.
Right.
The theaters on the East Coast, from Buffalo to Philadelphia, up and down the coast, would do these summer music festivals in these giant tents. They were like the Cirque du Soleil tents, and they were beautiful. They sat like 3,000 people. They had a rotating stage and everything. But he gave me tickets to see George Carlin.
And what an inspiration for comedy, George Carlin.
Oh, my God. The best.
One of the greatest.
Honestly.
Right.
He was so brilliant with words. And so I'd never seen a comedian do a long set. I mean, I saw him on The Tonight Show in those little controlled. And so he got up there and did 90 minutes.
Wow.
And I didn't understand the tricks of comedy, which is, you know, you build them out in modular form. You build 5 minutes and then you have 10 minutes and then you just go and you memorize it as you're going along. But this guy stood on stage and it seemed like he had never spoken the words before. He was just flawless and a great manipulator of language. And it was, I'm telling you, it was a religious experience for me.
Really?
At the end of that, I said, I can't believe somebody. And he had people convulsing. They were crying in the audience. And I thought, this guy's got a mystical power. And I never thought I could do it professionally. But I always, in the back of my mind, thought, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Wow. How do you memorize 90 minutes worth of comedy?
Well, for me, I'm not so famous where I have to use writers to give me volumes of material. Mm-hmm. So part of the joy for me is to actually write the material. I enjoy 50% of the joy is writing it and creating it.
Right.
And so after you write it and you try it and it doesn't work and you rewrite it and you try it again, by that time you've got it memorized because you created it and it's in your brain. So that's how it works for me. After a while, I do an hour, hour and 15 minutes now, and it's nothing.
Really? Yeah. There's nothing?
No.
Wow.
At my El Portal shows, I use an opening act for 15 minutes, and then I do an hour and 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And because most of the people there are my demographic, so I don't want to keep them away from the bathroom too long. So I give them 90 minutes, and it's a great show.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it. And the next show is June 23rd,
this
right?
This Sunday,
yes. Exactly.
We might be sold out, but we've been extended through November. I'm there once a month. Mm-hmm. All of our shows are at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoons once a month. And we have it early because, again, people of a certain demographic like to be home by dark. So we have everybody out of there. There are no politics.
Uh-huh.
I take people out of their heads for an hour and a half and they have a great time.
That's amazing. I'm sure they love you too because it's all people that have known you before.
Yes, yes.
Wow. Very cool. June 23rd, July 21st, August 18th, and where can people like be reminded of
this? You can go to two places. You can go to my website, which is fritzcolemancomedy.com. I have all the dates on my website, but it's easier if you go to the El Portal Theater. It's elportaltheater.com, and they have my listing in there. They have all the dates. They have a direct link to buy tickets. And it's a comfortable little, I'm in what's called the Marilyn Monroe Forum, which is a smaller theater inside the El Portal. It's 100 seats, so it's an intimate semicircular thing.
Yeah.
I get to make eye contact with everybody, and it's a blast. We're having
so much fun.
Yeah, very much so.
Wow. And you wrote the whole show, right?
Yes,
all the
exactly.
jokes and everything.
Yes.
When did you start this particular show?
This has been building over a couple of years. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes, and I don't work as much as many comedians do. You know, I'm not a young man, so I don't go out on the road six nights a week. I could grow this material faster if I did that. So it takes me about 2 years to grow a new hour. So it took me two and a half years to build this particular block of material.
And when was the first show? When did you start it?
Oh, I can't remember. It was shortly before I retired. I started doing it. But then I got this El Portal Theater booking, which allows me to do a longer format. When you work in most comedy clubs in L.A., you get 10 or 15 minutes, and you're one of seven or eight comedians to perform in one night.
Right.
And you really can't grow a large block of material over time because you take a little while for people to get used to who you are. You know, they know you as a weatherman, so you have to prove to them you're not going to have maps. You're not going to do a seven-day forecast. We're going to talk about other stuff. So it takes a while for them to grow, and so you get to do a longer, I get to do, you know, like an hour and 15 minutes, a longer period of time.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
In Philly?
West of Philly in a little town called Wayne, which was a spectacular place to grow up.
Really?
It was, if you're a history buff, Philadelphia is unbelievable.
Really?
I learned how to sled toboggan in Valley Forge Park, you know, where they still have the cabins where, you know, George Washington spent the winter of 76.
They still have them there?
Everything. Yeah, it's all there. And I mean, I lived right next door to a Revolutionary War cemetery. I mean, if you like history, it's an amazing place to grow up.
Yeah.
And it was, I lived about 30 miles outside the city of Philadelphia, and it was a great combination of the cosmopolitan aspect of Philly and the rural aspect of outside, you know, rolling hills. And it was great for a kid. Nobody locked their doors. The schools were spectacular. But, you know, I was a young man, and I had wanderlust, so I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there when I was younger. But then I look back on it as a parent. I thought I was so lucky. I grew up in a wonderful spot.
Yeah, that's a time when America was like really at its highest.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, I came to this country when I was 16 in the 70s, and it was a different world back then.
Did you come with your family, or did
no?
You come
I
by
came
yourself?
Alone. Actually,
man, bless your heart, man.
Yeah, I know. My family actually kind of sent me here. I stayed with some relatives for a while, then I moved on my own. But and they joined me 5 years later. But
did you come to do college here, or did you come just to start a life here?
No, just to start a life here, because that was my dad's dream, you know. So I was the foot in the door, so to speak, you know. And
well, you're what America's all about. And I hear all these fights about, I don't want to get into a political discussion, but, you know, the immigrant fight we're having now. Said, no, immigrants built this country.
Right.
Our greatest success stories are people who came here with nothing and created a life for themselves.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
You're a representative of that life.
Yeah. I just think that now, you know, without getting into politics, people want to see people coming in legally, you know?
Oh, no, I agree with that.
Because, you know, I think, like, the people that come here legally, they have to wait a long time. It's hard work to get into this country.
No,
it's not
I
easy,
agree.
You know?
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I think people talk from their emotions instead of their brains.
Right.
And there are people in, like, South Dakota who've probably never seen anybody from Mexico, but they're just against, you know, they're against the other automatically. And so we get into these things.
Yeah.
No, I agree with what you're saying, 100%.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but you're right. It is a country of immigrants, and it was the best thing I did in my life, you know. And
I
love my country of origin, but America is America, you know, and
that was very brave of you.
Yeah.
Did you speak any English before you got here?
I did. Yeah, we learned English in school and stuff. So it wasn't great English, but Getting into high school, I was sort of self-conscious about my accent and everything, and I still have a little bit of it. But people told me, you know, in fact, I was self-conscious of it when I first got on radio, you know, and I thought, who wants to hear someone with an accent? And people told me, they said, you know, don't be ashamed of it.
No, I mean, that that's makes what you makes different. You,
yeah, it makes
absolutely.
You unique, you know?
Absolutely.
And 16 years later, and people are telling me you're pretty good at it. So I'm like,
oh, no,
okay,
you are. You're
cool,
very good
you know?
At it. And that's the culture we're in now. We're a multicultural society.
Yeah.
And not everybody's the same.
And that's what makes it colorful, you
no,
know?
I mean, I agree.
People bring in different talents, different backgrounds, different everything, you know?
I agree.
And I'm just, you know, I really want to see America go back to it being the light of the nations, you know, in the world.
Yes.
And I don't think we are anymore, you
no.
know. People
no.
look down on us, and it's unfortunate, you know.
There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of divide. It's difficult to have a discussion with anybody without people getting really emotional about
right.
it. It's a bad moment.
Right.
And I hope you're right. I hope we can sort of stabilize and normalize after
yeah.
a while.
You know, I mean, we were the savior of the world, you know, World War One, World War Two. Until America got in, people could not, they didn't know what was going to happen, you know. And we came in and we saved the Western culture, you know, a few times. And I think we need that again, you know. We need to
people
be the
look
leader
up to
again.
Us. We're the leader of the world.
The leader,
and, you know,
exactly.
You heard the stories when Biden went over to speak at the G7 conference. People still say, we count on you. You have to get things stabilized.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pressure on him. It's like he has to
yeah.
recover the reputation of the country. He's just trying to run it crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Going back, so you grew up in Philly. Any siblings or are you?
No, I'm an only child.
An only child.
I had an inordinate need for attention as an only child, and that's why I became a comedian. You know, really.
I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Many comedians have, like, tough childhoods.
I had no tough childhood.
No, tough childhood.
People say, well, so why did you become a comedian? I say, because I think the greatest joy for me in my life was making other people laugh. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, making my father laugh. My father was a very funny man. And if I could make him laugh, I had a successful day.
Wow, that's
and
amazing.
So that never went away.
Yeah.
Because you look at the psychology behind having to go work in a club to drunk people at 1 o'clock in the morning and to make a room full of strangers appreciate you. Why is that important?
Yeah.
And I think it goes back to, I just love making my dad laugh. I
Whoa,
really think that, yeah.
What an amazing thing, you know?
Yeah.
I'm getting chills, you
yeah.
know? I mean, it's like
yeah.
a really nice thing, you know? I mean, it's like
yeah.
you want to please your parents and this is the way you did it.
That's
you know?
All. That's all. I was not. There was no darkness in my family. There, my dad was an alcoholic, but so was like a third of the men in the United States were after World War
right,
II.
Right.
It wasn't an abusive family life. It was lovely. And I just got into the business because that was the one thing I could do. It kept me out of trouble in high school. If I could make people laugh, I would keep from getting beat up. And, you know, seriously,
yeah.
I could fend off bullies with a sense of humor because then I could turn the crowd against the bully, you know. So
right.
it was just something I did.
Amazing.
But I have no darkness to tell about it.
Yeah. Now, when did you move out of Philadelphia? Did you move here to California?
Yes. Well, what happened was I went to college unsuccessfully one time.
Yeah.
I went to a little college in West Virginia, and I flunked out. And this was at a time when if you dropped below a C average in college,
mm-hmm.
you would lose your student deferment from the draft. They still had the draft.
Yeah.
So I well below C average.
And
so within about a month, I got a letter from the Defense Department. Please come down to 401 North Broad Street in Philadelphia. We'd like to give you a physical and consider you for employment. So I went down there and you made the decision to come to this country, which was a pivotal moment in your life. The best decision I ever made was I went down to get a physical with all these other guys. And all the military recruiters were there, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and Marines. And I knew, because it was the peak of the Vietnam War, this was 1969, that if I got drafted, I was going to go to Vietnam, And I thought I would love to serve my country. I have no problem serving my country. I thought I could do it better without a gun. I'm not a very violent person. So I just picked up all my clothes at my physical and went down the hall and enlisted in the Navy. And it was the single best decision I ever made.
Wow.
They sent me to school. I went to radio school in Great Lakes for 8 weeks. I worked for Armed Forces Radio and Television. It introduced me to my broadcasting career.
Amazing.
And honestly... my older son was having some trouble early in his life. I tried to talk him into it. He was too scared. I said, I would never want you to do something that I thought you would fail at. It saved my life. But that way, you know, everybody has to learn on their own.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing, you know. But I mean, you served the country in your own way.
Yes.
How old were you at the time?
I was 19 and I got out. I was in from 1969 to 1972. Mm-hmm. I enlisted for 4 years. But I got a 6 month early out because it was the end of the Vietnam War and Richard Nixon was downsizing the military. So he gave everybody in all services a 6 month early out. So instead of doing the 4 that I signed up for, I did 3.5 years.
I see. And after that, you moved to California or? And what
after that, I was in the radio business.
Okay.
I was a poor imitation of what you do. I did a talk show for a little while. I was a DJ. I did Top 40 radio. And I did that for 15 years.
That was in Philly?
It was in Philly. And then I went to Syracuse, New York, and then Buffalo, New York. Mm. And while in those days, when you were a DJ, you would get invited to host events at nightclubs. And I had an ongoing job as an MC at a jazz club in Buffalo, New York, very famous jazz room called the Tralfamador Cafe. Mm-hmm. Lots of famous jazz artists performed there, Sarah Vaughan, Spyro Gyra, you know, fusion bands. And I would be the opening act and the MC. Well, if you know anything about jazz, you worked in Vegas, anything about jazz musicians, they're not known for being punctual and starting on time.
Most musicians are
No, especially jazz guys. They're on their own cosmic clock, you know? So the show was advertised to start at 8 o'clock, and the owner of the room was charging a cover charge and a two-drink minimum. He said, I don't care if the band's not ready to go. I want my show to start at 8 o'clock. Uh-huh. So as a defense mechanism, I began to write material for myself so I would have something to show for 15 or 20 minutes while the band decides to, you know, get their trumpet together and get out on the stage. And so I wrote my first comedy act as a defense so I'd have something to say when these people are in the audience. And I developed some confidence at that, and I developed a little following. And I thought, you know, I want to do this for a living. So in 1980, I sold my car for $5,000. I sold an insurance policy for $10,000. Mm-hmm. I thought $15,000, I'll be able to live for a year in California. Never having been here, I got out here, it lasted like 3.5 months because first in the, and so I came out here in 1980 to do comedy and did the open mics and worked my way up. And then the story I told you about when.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
And ever since then, you've been in California?
Ever since, yes. I've been here almost 50 years.
In L.A.?
Yes.
Just in L.A.
Yeah, San Fernando Valley.
Wow.
Glendale, Burbank, North
which
Hollywood.
Is right near here, by the way, if you guys don't know. Mm-hmm. San Fernando Valley. That's where a lot of action happens.
It's like the Brooklyn of Southern California.
Yeah.
It's the suburbs of L.A.
That's true. It is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's true. It is. We have a couple of your clips from the new show, and I wanted to play it.
Please.
So here we're going to hear Fritz doing a couple of they're not long, but they're funny. I haven't heard them yet. I heard one.
I hope you like them. If not, I'm leaving.
Here we go.
When you get old, various parts of your body decide to make changes without notifying you ahead of time. Your chest says, I don't want to be a chest anymore. I want to retire and move south and become a stomach. So your chest becomes your stomach. How does that happen? When you get old, you eat less, but your stomach gets bigger. When you're old, you drink less, yet you pee more. How does that happen? The good news is when you drink less, you also perspire less. And if you're old, that means you can wear the same outfit 3 days in a row. I started this outfit Wednesday.
Wow. That's funny, man. But it's true. You know, I mean, I've got my belly here, and I'm like, you know.
No, you take good care of yourself. Now, I can tell. You lose weights a little bit?
Yeah, I used to. Lately, I haven't been doing a lot of exercise. But, no, I mean, I think most people at our age, well, you're very skinny, so you don't have to worry about
it. It's a genetic glitch.
But for many people, they're self-conscious about their stomach, you know, because everything goes down old there, like you said.
This show is about being old.
Right.
It's called Unassisted Living. And it's just me talking about the common experiences of getting old. As I say, there's no politics. I think comedians have a really interesting job right now with what we were talking about earlier, the darkness in the world and the divide. I think the comedian's job is to just take people out of their heads for an hour, let them think about something else, leave the troubles at the front door,
right,
and just, you know, give them a chance to release and talk about what's common in us and not what divides us.
Exactly. You know,
and so that's what this show does.
Yeah, you relate to them, you know, and they can relate to you because you're talking about things that they deal with every day, you know? Amazing, amazing. So you've had, like, different shows over the years, right?
Yes. I do a thing. I know I didn't invent this, but I came up with a name for it. It's called a single-topic monologue. For about the last 25 years, I do a show, but I make each show about something. For instance, the first one I did was called It's Me, Dad. It was about me being a father. The second one I did was called The Reception. It was about divorce. The third one I did was about the news, called Tonight at 11. The fourth one I did was my first one about aging, called Defying Gravity. And then this one is called Unassisted Living. This is, I've gone past being surprised that I'm old. Now I know I'm old. And I'm just, and I'm describing the, you know, the common experiences of being older.
Yeah. But you know, the amazing thing, and I'm sure you'll agree, is that in your mind, you don't feel old, you know, because it's just like you feel like you're 20 years old still, because it's you're in your mind.
If you're in good health, you have no sense of how old you really are.
Right. You know, but then people look at you and they go, oh, you're in your 60s, you're old, you know. But you don't feel it, you know, and
100%.
And I think that's the thing that people have to hold on to when they get older, you know. Don't feel old, you know. Even if you look old.
No, it's actually dangerous, because when you feel old, you'll be old and you'll act old, and your body will respond to that.
Right.
You just have to keep going. That's where I am in my life. I mean, I have a little health stuff, because you can't get away with everything.
Can't get away with
I'm busy, and it makes me feel like a young man.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Good for you. Now the next one is called smoking, and I wanna listen to that one. I can relate. I used to smoke.
Me too.
Did you really?
2 packs a day.
Wow. And when did you quit? Remember?
In September, or in 1978.
Oh, wow.
I had a really bad throat infection, and I couldn't eat solid food, and it was the only time in my life I just had no desire to smoke. And after about 2 weeks, I said, you know, I'm going to see if I can keep going with this.
Yeah.
So I went out and I started running. That's when I began to jog, and I was driving, and I worked my way up to like 10 miles a day. And it was therapeutic, because it winded me, and I had no desire to smoke, so I haven't smoked since.
Yeah, exactly. You lose the desire when you work out and stuff. For me, it was a more serious circumstance. I had a stroke like 5 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and you see, I mean, I came out unscathed. Which
you
is,
look so healthy. That's why I said, do you work out? Because you look like you take great care
of yourself. Thank you. Well, I did, you know. So, but the thing is that, yeah, it was very unexpected and everything. I had a blood clot, I guess, in my head. And you know, I got the stroke, and I'm so fortunate, because usually people don't come out of it alive, or if they do, something's wrong with them, you know. So I'm, like, so grateful. I said, this is the writing on the wall, you know. And the doctor said, if you keep smoking, you'll be right back in here.
Mm-hmm.
And that scared me enough. And I said, you know what? Enough is enough, you know. And, today being a smoker is like being a pariah, you know.
Oh, I know. It's too hard. You got to walk 4 blocks to go smoke.
Yeah, exactly. You have to stand away from people. And people think of you like, you know, people feel sorry for you, like you're a slave to this. You have to do it. And it's just not, you know, especially in L.A., it's totally
such a
not.
Bad, disgusting habit. I'm so really glad is, I was able to quit. Man.
I don't know why I enjoyed it, but.
I loved it. Having a cup of coffee and a cigarette. Are you kidding?
Yeah, exactly. But you stink, and these people stink. They go get into an elevator with someone that smokes and can't stand it. You know, it's too much. It's way too much. So let's listen to the clip with smoking from Fritz Goldman.
Both of my parents smoked a lot in the car with the window rolled up. You could not even see out of the car. People are driving by going, look, it's the new Pontiac brush fire. It's the first one. It's... Parenting was different back then. My father never changed a diaper. He'd say, let him do it himself. That's how he'll learn. Okay.
That's funny, but it's true, you know. Mm-hmm. So your father was funny, too. He had very a sense funny. Of humor.
He was a very dry wit.
Really?
And he had the Jack Benny school of humor, and that is, he didn't have to be the center of attention in a room. He would come in, and he would listen to other people, and he would assess the moment. Mm-hmm. And then there was a brief break in the conversation. My father would lay a line in there that would convulse the room. He knew great timing. And he knew to use it sparingly, and it made it even funnier. Wow. He's a very funny man.
Yeah, yeah. What did he do for a living?
He was a salesman. He was the vice president of sales for an international construction materials company. Like, they sold cement and sand and slag and stone to large projects. For instance, he sold the surface material for the Ontario airport. I mean, he was very good, a very good salesman. Wow. I was a salesman, but I didn't ask people to send me money. I just asked them to believe me when I did the weather. But what I did was, and being stand-up comic, you're selling yourself on stage. So I got that gene and my humor gene from my dad.
Yeah, cool. Now, from being a weatherman, did you get any gigs because of that?
Yes. I mean, When that was my introduction to the importance of giving back when you're doing well. Mm. Because when I was on the air, people would invite me to come and either perform or speak at or MC at nonprofit events. And they would say, if you just come, we can double the price of our ticket. We'll have more people there. And I thought, how can I not do that? It takes literally no extra effort on my part. So I helped raise a lot of money for the nonprofit world that way, and it became so important. It wasn't like I was in the trenches, you know, serving homeless people dinner every day, but I was able to raise a significant amount of money for many nonprofits.
Yeah, you made your own contribution.
Yes, and so, and that became, honestly, the most satisfying part of my career.
Really?
Was doing community outreach work and nonprofit work.
Good for you. Good for you. Mm-hmm. We're almost running out of time. I want to play a couple more clips. This one is on car buying. I'm curious to hear that one. So let's see what that one's about.
And I can start your car on your phone? That's just obnoxious, isn't it? God forbid you have to walk to the driveway to start your car. I can see if you're Michael Corleone and you're worried about somebody planting a bomb under your hood, but you're just a man who, no offense, sir, has gotten a little puffy during the pandemic. You need to get more daily steps in. So walk the 45 steps of the car. It'll do you a world of good. And forget starting a car on the phone. Now you can buy a car on your phone, which is immoral. You should not be allowed to buy a car in your stinking phone. Buying a car should be a painful, drawn-out experience. So you make the right decision. You should be forced to walk from dealership to dealership along the entire Bellflower Boulevard of cars. You should be forced to fend off irritating sales trolls with pepper spray. You should be forced to spend an additional 2 hours in the sales office negotiating your sports package, which turns out to be a suction cup phone holder. That's what buying a car should be, not this. Oh my God, I was trying to buy porch furniture and accidentally bought a Porsche. Then before you get home, the Carvana drone lowers a 911 turbo you don't want onto your front yard.
Little snippets, no politics, just...
Yeah. This is true, you know. I mean, you're talking about things that are true, you know, that people go through every day. In fact, I went and helped my son buy a car the other day, And, you know, we sit there, and I'm like, why don't they just let us sit here for hours? I mean, what are they doing
they
in the back?
They wear you out. Know? They wear you down until you just say yes so you can get out of there.
Right. But you know what? We already agreed on the thing, yeah. And now the paperwork, you know? And they just want to, like, I don't know what they're doing in the back there.
Then they bring in the closer. Wait, I have to get my boss to sign off on this. Then they bring another guy out. It's just awful. It's an awful experience.
It really is, you know, and... You're right, though, but, you know, people buy cars off of a phone now, like the Tesla, right? You can buy a Tesla on the phone.
Crazy.
It really is, you know. I mean, you're buying a $60,000 something, you know, and you do it on the phone. It's amazing,
it
you know.
It seems wrong.
I know. We do everything on the phone today, you know. And the thing is that people are complaining that the little kids are so addicted to these phones, but... Essentially, what they're doing is they're copying us.
Absolutely. We're teaching them all those habits.
Exactly. I mean, yep. We're on the phone all the time, too. Mm-hmm. But we want our kids to do something else. But after all, they're just imitating you, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you want to get your kids off the phone, you got to get off the phone, too. You know?
Well, it's an interesting time because Governor Newsom, did you hear what he did yesterday?
No.
He wants to sign a law for the entire state of California, which makes it illegal for kids to have active phones in school. So they have to turn them off and put them in their backpack or check them somewhere when they go, and they can't operate their phones all day long.
Yeah.
I support that. I just think it's,
yeah,
you know, it will teach them to be away from those devices for a period of time.
That's true.
Because with the bullying and everything, it's really hard.
Right.
When I was raising my kids, I would say to them, the problem is when I was growing up, if you had a beef with somebody at school, like a bully was picking on you or you had a disagreement and you went home for the weekend, everything cooled down because there was no way for them to communicate with you. They're not going to call you. They don't know your phone number. So things settled down. Now, if you have a beef with somebody or there's something on the internet, you can't get away from it because they're doing it all weekend, 24/7.
Right.
It's awful. So I don't disagree with that.
Right. And you don't know with AI and everything. I mean, it's scary because they're doing like deep fake nudes
very
and things like
so.
That, you know.
Very much so.
And you go, you know, what? How is this going to end? You know, I mean, it's not going to end well. I don't know.
No,
I'm really worried
that.
About AI. You know,
yeah.
I really am.
Yeah.
And I mean, even the inventors of this are like, one of the guys quit Google just so he can tell people how dangerous
yes.
it's going to be. You
and
know?
Even the guy that did ChatGPS is saying we need to get a handle on this.
Right.
He was almost appealing to Congress to make some parameters for this thing so we don't yeah. put ourselves in trouble.
Yeah, Sam Altman, I think his name
yeah,
is.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, and it's too bad, you know. And but I've always wondered why they let the kids' phones in the class anyway. Because, I mean, you can cheat like that, you know?
Yes.
I mean, well, you know, what use is it to give them a test if they can all cheat, you know?
Yeah.
We used to pass notes in the car, in the class, remember?
And when it starts at home.
Yeah.
If you go to a restaurant now, you'll see a family of four sitting at a table, mm-hmm. and nobody's talking.
Right.
Everybody's on their phone.
Right.
The kids are texting their friends. The parents are, you know, yelling at one another or something. It's just part of this habit has grown at home.
Yeah, I agree, you know, and my question is, why do we prefer to be somewhere else? Because the phone takes you somewhere else. You're not present with the people you're with, you know? And I'm like, why are we so eager to be outside or away from the situation we're in right now?
Exactly.
You're sitting there with your friends, with your family and everything, you know? So, I mean, I know I don't get on the phone when I'm with people, you know, unless it's an emergency or something right. urgent, you know?
Right.
But, yeah, just be present with the people. I mean, what happened to interaction, you know? And then the younger people, all they do is text. They don't really know how to talk to each other. And I don't know how this is going to end, you know?
No.
But it's like
because
all this technology.
The companies refuse to put their own parameters in there, and Congress refuses to do it. Somebody's going to have to make some rules and regulations.
Yeah. I don't know if it's going to help, though. I mean, what are they going to tell you? Don't pull out your phone when you're home with your
family.
No,
I know. It's already too ingrained in our society.
It really is, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Well, Fritz, we're out of time.
Wow, that was fast.
Yeah, I'm really glad you came in. You know, I was
looking
forward to
it. Thank you. It was a great conversation.
It.
You're very good, and you're fun to talk to.
And so are you. You know, I mean, you're a great guest, great comedian. I'm planning on coming on Sunday. I have to work at 4, but we'll see. Maybe I can do something and change it around.
Well, you can come. We're there till November.
Yeah.
So you can pick a weekend and come and be my guest.
I'd exactly. Love to have you. I'll have people pre-record so I don't have to be here, and I'll come and see the show.
That'd be awesome.
Because I'm really tempted to see it.
Love to see you.
Tell people how they can find you.
Okay, so there are two ways to get that. Well, I'm. You can find all my social media and everything at fritzcolemancomedy.com. Okay. You can also use that email address to get tickets for my shows, mm-hmm. or you can go to the theater, which is actually a faster way to do it, at the El Portal Theater. It's E-L, new word, P-O-R-T-A-L Theater. It's on Lancashire Boulevard, elportaltheater.com.
Right.
And they have a list of all their shows. They have a list of all my shows, and you can buy tickets for upcoming shows and come and see. You'll have a good time.
Yeah, yeah. Most people in L.A. have heard of the El Portal, I think.
It's a famous theater. It's a famous
really
venue.
It really mm-hmm. is. Yeah. It's North Hollywood?
North Hollywood, Lancashire Boulevard. It's right across the street from the Lamley Theater.
Right.
North Hollywood's trying really hard to be WeHo. They're trying to be West Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this little cool little area there, and it's a fun place.
Wonderful. Fritz Coleman, good luck to you.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate the chance to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for giving us the weather for so many years in comedy now, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you, Sam.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
Listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.